Welcome to the In Context War Report, produced by MDR Productions, Inc. The In Context War Report is broadcast at noon on the fourth Monday of the month on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. Our website is incontextreport.com. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I'm joined by the War Report's military affairs commentator, Marshawn McDermott Rowe. In today's show, we're going to take a close look at urban warfare, its historical development, and its important role in warfare today. But first, let's take a look at recent developments in war and geopolitics around the world and see how these events affect global stability and U.S. national security. Now, I want to note that while war and national security is the subject of this program, it should not be understood that war necessarily advances national security. On the contrary, the objective of military policy and foreign policy should be to advance the national interest without losing soldiers or diverting scarce resources that could be better spent on raising U.S. living standards. With this in mind, let's look at developments in the dangerous confrontation between Russia and the United States. On April 12th, two Russian jets buzzed a U.S. guided missile destroyer in the Baltic Sea, flying as low as 75 feet above the ship. It was characterized as a simulated strafing attack. Secretary of State Kerry said that the U.S. would have had the right to shoot the Russian planes down. Marshawn, what was the reason for this Baltic Sea confrontation?
Well, the Baltic Sea confrontation really can be seen in the wider NATO-Russian conflict that's been developing. The United States, really since the Obama administration came to power in 2008, has been pushing the Russians in the Ukraine, in Georgia, in the Baltic. And certainly we have to remember that the Baltic Sea is a Russian sea, just as the Caspian Sea is seen as a Russian sea. We have to remember that the Baltic for the Russians has a tremendous historical value. That's the whole reason why Peter the Great expanded Russian borders to the Baltic. He fought a war with the Swedes to gain the Baltic region. He built St. Petersburg to be a city, to be his capital on the Baltic. The Baltic to the Russians is essential, not just for strategic value, but it is essential from a historical perspective, just as Crimea is. We tend to look at this from a very sort of American-centric perspective. We say, well, why is Crimea important? Why is the Baltic important? Well, the Baltic was made a Russian sea by Peter the Great. He put his first navy to sea from St. Petersburg. Ships that he built himself were launched from St. Petersburg. He assisted physically in the building of the Russian navy. And then, of course, Crimea, similarly, was the birthplace of the Russian Orthodox Church. When we wonder why this confrontation is building, why would the Russians feel provoked by us sailing ships into the Baltic, it's very clear that this would be antagonizing from a historical as well as from a political perspective. It's tantamount to the Russians sailing a fleet up the Gulf of Mexico.
And of course, Marshawn, the Baltic states used to be republics within the Soviet Union, and bringing these Baltic states within NATO was part of this strategic decision made by the United States at the end of the Cold War to incorporate former Soviet republics, members of the former Warsaw Pact, the Russian Defensive Alliance, into NATO, which has essentially evolved into an anti-Russian alliance. And we need to remember also that the city of Kaliningrad, formerly Konigsberg, is within the Baltic region. This is an ethnic Russian enclave, population of 1 million people. It's interesting. It's a non-contiguous part of Russia that's stuck between Lithuania and Poland on the Baltic. It was once a part of East Prussia, but at the end of World War II, the ethnic Germans were expelled by the Russians and replaced by Russian settlers. So, Marshawn, what does Kaliningrad mean strategically to the Russians?
Kaliningrad is essential because it's a Russian toehold in Western Europe. We have to remember that Russia is separated from Western Europe by the Ukraine, Belarus, the Baltic states, and Poland. But Kaliningrad gives them a foothold inside Western Europe. And that's one of the reasons why the Russians, specifically in Kaliningrad, what used to be Konigsberg, expelled all the ethnic Germans and brought in all these Russian settlers. Stalin wanted to establish a ethnic Russian toehold in Western Europe. It's important because also the Russians have a very large military force in Kaliningrad. Not only does Russia have ground assets in Kaliningrad, such as armored divisions, but they also have air assets stationed there. They even have naval forces stationed in Kaliningrad. This, in effect, blocks U.S. efforts to come to the rescue of the Baltic states. Granted, we could sweep up through Poland to come to their rescue, but the fact is that the Poles and our other NATO allies would be far more concerned of the 100,000 Russian troops stationed in Kaliningrad than they are of losing the Baltic states. It would immediately put NATO on the back foot. So Kaliningrad is strategically very significant.
Now, Marchand, if the Russians and the United States and its NATO allies came to war in the Baltic states, how would you see it evolving? Would the main offensive come from Kaliningrad? Would troops have to cross the Baltics to get to the front from Russia? What kind of forces could NATO muster to oppose the Russians?
NATO is relying very heavily on the armies of Poland, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, countries like Romania. NATO is relying on these Eastern European countries to provide, at least it appears, the bulk of the fighting force. But with Kaliningrad threatening Poland, Poland is going to be slow to commit most of its army to defend Estonia when they might be more worried about defending their own borders. Most likely, a Russian advance into the Baltic states would come directly across the Russian border with the Baltic states. There were some military analysts I've read that estimate that the Baltic states could be completely occupied by Russia within 36 hours. And that's pretty fast when you think about it. And that's in spite of the U.S. forces stationed there. But we have to remember, Russia can mobilize in the ballpark of 200,000 troops within 48 hours. That's one of the estimates I've read. Within 72 hours, it can mobilize upwards of 400,000 troops. Russia regularly holds snap drills. And when we see the number of troops that they mobilize during these snap drills, it's incredible. But that's why, I mean, the Baltic states really wouldn't stand a chance. Their forces would be very rapidly overwhelmed. Not to mention, in a lot of them, there are very large ethnic Russian communities which would support the Russians, which may act as saboteurs behind the NATO lines, which may indeed act as guerrilla forces or support Russian covert operations inside these countries. So we have to remember that in Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, these countries have been part of Russia since the days of the Russian Empire. It's only recently that they've been independent. So there are very large numbers of ethnic Russians living there. A Russian army would probably sweep in from the Russian border with the Baltic states, with Estonia most likely, move south, and Kaliningrad would be used to keep NATO on its back foot, keep Poland from acting. Any U.S. reinforcements would take far more than 36 hours to mobilize.
Let's talk about the U.S. side. How many U.S. troops are in Europe? I understand there's a significant garrison still in Germany, but would they move up to a war in the Baltic states?
Most of the forces in Germany at this stage are support, medical units, intelligence units, air assets. Since the end of the Cold War, and particularly since 2008 and the withdrawal from Iraq, the withdrawal for the most part from Afghanistan, and of course the defense cuts, the number of U.S. troops in Germany and in Europe as a whole has dwindled tremendously and been reduced largely to support units. M1 Abrams tanks have been stationed in Romania. There have been a few stationed in Poland, along with Bradley fighting vehicles, which are all fine and dandy, but these are stationed without crews. The purpose is to be staged so that in the event of war, the armored assets are already there. The problem is that by and large, these are a drop in the bucket. We can't mobilize anywhere near what the Russians can mobilize in terms of they can mobilize whole tank divisions. We don't have that at our disposal. We have only a handful of brigade combat teams still left. So most of the units currently available in Europe are largely support elements. As I mentioned, medical, air assets, intelligence assets, which are great, but we lack those large armored divisions that are necessary for a war in Eastern Europe. So even if we were to mobilize those forces, they would not be in sufficient quantity to stop several hundred thousand Russian soldiers sweeping across the border.
And as you suggest, a war in Eastern Europe would likely be heavily an armor war.
Absolutely. The scenario played out by every intelligence agency in every country was that a war in Eastern Europe would be an armored war. And we see that go all the way through to the 20th century. In the Cold War, every battle plan was for an armored war in Eastern Europe. Because we have to remember, Eastern Europe is tank country. Eastern Europe is largely flat. The steppes of Ukraine, the steppes of Belarus, Poland is flat. That's why it's been prone to invasion. Eastern Europe is tank country. Now, I have heard it argued that, well, the United States, we possess drones and we have a great air force. That's all dandy. But in reality, the Russians have technology to match ours. Our drones are not going to be able to fly with impunity the way they do over Afghanistan. The Russians rely very heavily on their surface-to-air missile systems, these mobile surface-to-air missile systems, the S-300, most recently the S-400 system. The S-400, as far as we know, may in fact be capable of shooting down all of our stealth aircraft. We don't know this for certain because it hasn't yet actually gone up against our stealth aircraft. If it is even remotely possible that these things can shoot down our B-2 bombers, they can shoot down our F-22s, they can shoot down the F-35, which actually isn't combat capable and may never be. But the fact is, if in theory it can threaten these aircraft, it threatens our air superiority, in which case, if we cannot guarantee air superiority, then it comes down to tanks on the battlefield. And that's the way a war in Eastern Europe, a war in Western Europe, or any kind of superpower struggle would work. It was General Mike Miley, who's the chief of staff of the Army, had said that the United States now is incapable of fighting a superpower struggle, a war against, and he specifically mentioned Russia, China, Iran, or North Korea, because our forces have been cut so drastically. And that's because in a counterinsurgency war, you rely on military police, you rely on training and assisting and advising forces. You're not using large armored battalions. If you're talking about a war in Eastern Europe where the Russians are mobilizing 400,000 men, 1,200 tanks, I mean, at that stage, 14 Abrams tanks and 30 Bradleys really aren't going to, they're not going to be a drop in the bucket in that kind of battle. And that is what we're likely to see.
And Marshawn, how about the naval side? That's bound to be an important aspect of a war in the Baltic area.
The Russians and the U.S. have two different approaches to naval warfare. The Russians rely very heavily on submarines. Their naval doctrine seems to demonstrate that submarines for them are the wave of the future. They've invested very heavily in intercontinental ballistic missiles, the Blue Lava missile. They've invested very heavily in the Bore-class submarine, this new, quote-unquote, stealth submarine that, as far as we know, is very, very difficult to detect. While we have been refurbishing aircraft carriers, the Russians have been investing in submarines. Now, I've often heard analysts mock the Russians for only having one aircraft carrier, but they view the aircraft carrier by and large as anachronistic. The submarine is capable of sneaking into your ports and striking your cities. That in of itself is a great enough weapon. The carrier battle group is essential to U.S. naval warfare. You have the aircraft carrier at the center, or several aircraft carriers depending on the situation, and you have cruisers and destroyers around it as part of the group. You have support ships, you have submarines, and but the aircraft carrier is the center. What makes the submarine so dangerous is that if one Russian Bore-class submarine could slip into that fleet and sink the aircraft carrier, it makes your carrier battle group virtually ineffective, not to mention the potential for severe casualties. It's the same reason why the Chinese have invested so heavily in submarine technology. In terms of a war in the Baltics, we're seeing two wildly different approaches, one based heavily on aircraft carriers and surface ships, the other based very heavily on submarine warfare.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. I'm Ken McDermott Rowe, your host, and I'm joined by Marshawn McDermott Rowe, our military affairs commentator. We've been talking about the recent confrontation between the United States and Russia in the Black Sea, which involved two Russian fighter jets doing a simulated strafing run very low over a U.S. destroyer. Now we'd like to move on to another area of Russian-U.S. confrontation, potential Russian-U.S. confrontation, and that's in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia, which is now an independent republic. Georgia is located just south of Russia on the east side of the Black Sea. It's a very important location because of pipeline routes and because Georgia serves as a buffer for Russia against its centuries-old enemy, Turkey. Next month, the United States plans a military exercise in Georgia, and these Georgia exercises are part of the NATO military expansion on the Russian periphery. The Baltic states was part of it, and the United States has attempted to bring Georgia into NATO, which has essentially become an anti-Russian military alliance. The United States has signed a strategic partnership agreement with Georgia. This partnership agreement was actually opposed by France and Germany, who feel that it could unnecessarily provoke Russia. And the United States has even committed to protecting Georgia's territorial integrity against Russia. Now, Marshawn, there's actually been fighting between the Russians and the Georgians. Could you talk about the conflict of the past and that's ongoing now?
the best way to begin is to begin with 1990 and the collapse of the Soviet Union. When the Soviet Union fell apart, South Ossetia declared its independence from Georgia. In 1991, Georgia decided to reassert control over South Ossetia and Abkhazia, the two breakaway regions, because these regions are predominantly ethnic Russian. They'd been part of Georgia, more or less the Georgian Socialist Republic, when it was part of the Soviet Union, but they were nominally also autonomous regions. So 1991, Georgia attempted to reassert control over the regions. This led to the 1991 to 1992 South Ossetia War. After the conflict, the regions were nominally autonomous. Russian peacekeepers came in. And then in 2008, Georgia decided it once again wanted to reassert control over the region. And there's a lot of debate over who started it, who opened fire on the Russian peacekeepers first. But the fact is that Georgia attempted to reassert control over the two breakaway republics. And this led to a Russian invasion of Georgia and South Ossetia, albeit, again, there were peacekeepers already present, but the Russian forces came in nominally to protect the independence of predominantly ethnic Russian areas of South Ossetia and Abkhazia. And the Georgian forces were pulverized. The conflict culminated with the occupation of one of Georgia's most important naval bases and the sinking of virtually its entire navy by Russian combat engineers. This was meant, more or less, at least in my opinion, as a demonstration that no NATO naval assets would be safe in the country, but also that Georgia was not truly protected by NATO, because without direct NATO intervention, Georgia's army was ultimately destroyed completely.
Russian troops are still there, right?
The Russian military is stationed in South Ossetia, in Abkhazia, and also most South Ossetians and Abkhazians hold Russian passports. So more or less, it is a de facto region of Russia now.
The European Commission's have a Southern Gas Corridor project, which is planning on bringing natural gas from the Caspian Sea through Azerbaijan and Georgia and Turkey to Europe. So this is going to be an extremely important energy source for the Europeans. And that's one of the reasons why they're very concerned about maintaining peace there. Another strategic aspect, and I think you mentioned it about the battles between the Russians and the Georgian navies, is that the ports of Georgia on the Black Sea could give Russia access to the Black Sea. And of course, it's always looking for more outlets to warm water ports.
The Black Sea has been essential to Russian national security. It's the same reason why Peter the Great fought brutal naval engagements with the Turks in order to gain control of the Black Sea.
Marchand, I can understand why Georgia, next door to Russia, would be of strategic importance to the Russians, and given this natural gas pipeline that's planned through Georgia, why it'd be so important to the EU. But why is it so important to the United States?
Under the administration of George Bush Jr., there was a warming of relations with Russia, but there also came to be an understanding with the Russians. The Bush administration had the understanding with Russia that you have your spheres of influence, we have ours. Russia needs a buffer zone, and we respected Russia's buffer zone. In the same way, though, Russia respected ours. When President Obama came to power, there became this policy of containment. We are going to push the Russians. We are going to contain the Russians. So we began actively pushing for these countries that had, up until this point, been more or less Russian proxies, pushing them into NATO, stationing NATO and, more importantly, U.S. troops there. And additionally, we began pushing the Russians in places like Ukraine, toppling the Ukrainian government, arming the Georgian army, arming countries that were inherently hostile to the Russians or that had previously been Russian satellites. And of course, allowing our NATO allies like Turkey to support countries like Azerbaijan in conflicts against pro-Russian countries like Armenia. So there developed over the years in the Obama administration this philosophy that we are going to push and contain the Russians. Why, I do not know, because conflict with Russia has never benefited U.S. national security. Having a balance like we had during the Cold War was essential to U.S. national security.
Now, Marchand, you mentioned Azerbaijan, and that is another flashpoint for potential Russian-U.S. conflict, at least through surrogates. Azerbaijan is a very oil-rich former Soviet republic that's located just south and east of Georgia with a coastline on the Caspian Sea. Baku, the capital of Azerbaijan, has been an important center of oil production for over a century. And the current Azerbaijan government is pro-Western with a military partnership with NATO also. Azerbaijan recently attacked Nagorno-Karabakh, a largely autonomous Armenian enclave within Azerbaijan. And it's also reported that the Azeris have shelled towns inside neighboring Armenia, which is an independent republic, another former part of the Soviet Union. So the Russians seem to be supporting the Armenians, while Turkey, with tacit U.S. approval, is supporting Azerbaijan. So could you talk a little about that conflict?
Well, again, it was one of these so-called frozen conflicts that took place following the collapse of the Soviet Union. Countries, again, jockeying for influence. Now, Nagorno-Karabakh is inside Azerbaijan, but it's a predominantly Armenian enclave. Now, depending on who you ask, because I've seen interviews and I've read reports from both sides of the conflict, and of course, everybody claims that they originally owned Nagorno-Karabakh. During the early 90s, there was a war between Azerbaijan and Armenia for control of Nagorno-Karabakh, and the Azeris were ultimately kicked out. So it has remained a nominally autonomous region, but ethnically Armenian and tied directly, of course, to Armenia. Now, what's important is to put this in the wider context. The Azeris of Azerbaijan have always been connected very strongly to Turkey. This goes back to the days of the Ottoman Empire, when the Ottomans sent an army to persecute the Armenians, but also to support the Azeris against the Russians. Armenia, on the other hand, has always been very close to Russia. And part of the reason for this is because during the days of the Ottoman-Russian conflicts, Armenia was a Christian enclave inside Ottoman territory. So the Russians, who saw themselves not only as the defenders of the Slavs, but the defenders of Christendom, they viewed themselves as the successors of Constantinople, of the Eastern Roman Empire, they felt obligated to defend the Armenians. So the tie between the Armenians and the Russians goes back hundreds of years, as does the tie between the Ottomans, the Turks, and the Azeris. So in this sort of proxy conflict, again, it is a direct threat to Russia because Armenia is tied to Russia by history. They fought wars to defend Armenia. Armenia is, in many ways, while they are their own independent country, they are historically a Russian satellite. By Turkey threatening Armenia, it is, in effect, NATO threatening Russia, because Russia also has troops stationed in Armenia.
Marshawn, this is one of the strange twists of geopolitics, because the Armenians were the victims of this horrible genocide about a century ago at the hands of the Turks. And one would think that the United States would tend to have sympathies with the Armenians, not with the Azeris.
Historically, we've always sort of picked and chosen our genocides to take interest in. We took such a front to Bashar al-Assad bombing political dissidents, as they were, or rebels. We took such a front to Muammar Gaddafi bombing rebels, but yet we refuse to force Turkey to acknowledge the Armenian genocide. We refuse to press Robert Mugabe on the massacre, the genocide committed against the Ndebele in Matabele land committed in the 1980s and 1990s. So we really do, in a lot of ways, pick our genocides. And a lot of this has to do with the fact that the Turks are our allies. The Turks are members of NATO. We will not call them on a genocide that everybody knows happened because there are photographs of it. And we will not call them on it because they are members of NATO, in the same way that Robert Mugabe has given Anglo-American mining access to Zimbabwe's natural resources. We will not call him on his massacre of the Ndebele, or indeed the European farmers. So you do see this pattern in U.S. geopolitics, that at the end of the day, security concerns and political expediency often trump morality.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. I'm Ken McDermott Rowe, your host, and I'm joined by Marshawn McDermott Rowe, our military affairs commentator. And we've been talking about the conflicts between Russia and the United States and various parts of the world. The In Context Report is broadcast on the fourth Monday of the month from noon to one. You can download this or prior editions of the War Report to your computer or mobile device from our website, incontextreport.com, or from SoundCloud under WPKN Community Radio. The show is also archived at Radio for All. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and write to us at ken@mdrtalk.org. In today's show, we're going to take a close look at a type of combat that is critical in modern conflicts, urban warfare. We'll look at the origins of urban warfare, how it differs from previous military engagements around cities, and what role it has played in modern wars. Marshawn, let's start with a basic question. Why are cities an important military objective?
Well, they've always been an important military objective because they are the center of government. They are the center of administration for a region. And of course, they're a hub for armies. They are a recruitment center. They are a resource for any army. But also, more importantly, they are a stronghold, the same as any hill or mountain or any natural feature can be a stronghold, but particularly cities, because you can't just bypass a city. If you bypass it, if an enemy takes refuge in the city and you bypass it to seek out the main enemy force or seek out another enemy force, that army simply leaves and attacks you from behind. So cities provide stronghold, defensive strongholds, as well as eventual jumping off points for an offensive. So cities have always, going back to ancient times, been essential to warfare.
How were cities captured prior to the development of modern urban warfare?
Traditionally speaking, so you would have layers of defenses in a city, usually layers of walls. Constantinople was the best example of that, but we have numerous examples, I mean, going all the way back to the Middle Ages, where you would have an exterior wall, and then you would have an interior wall and another interior wall, and then you'd have a keep, the central hub of everything inside the castle, but also the last line of defense. And so you'd have to scale the first wall, take it, scale the second wall, take it, scale the third wall, and then eventually you'd take the keep, and the city would be yours, and you'd murder and pillage your way across the city. But with the advent of the cannon, the walls started to become more and more irrelevant, because the Battle of Constantinople was actually the first major battle in which the cannon was used to knock holes in walls. And with that, we saw siege warfare evolve into something new. So now, instead of having men on ladders and whatnot having to try to climb over the top of the wall, now you just simply knocked a hole in the wall, and that hole in the wall became the center of fighting. Pretty much at this stage, everything else that went on around the castle became more or less irrelevant. Before, you'd mine your way under a wall and hope to collapse the wall, but now you had a guaranteed way of knocking a hole in the wall. The problem is it also allowed your enemy to concentrate all his defenses, because the enemy would focus on that one hole in the wall, and it would become this brutal slogging match for what was called the breach. As warfare evolved and we see the advent of the gun, that concept of the breach still remained, because once that section was taken, once you took the breach, you could pour your men in the city, and really at that point, unless it was a secondary wall, that was it. The battle was over, every man for himself at that stage, and as I mentioned, loot and pillage. So we do see a gradual change in terms of technology, but not really in the fundamentals up through the Napoleonic period.
Marshawn, speaking of the Napoleonic period, I think a good example of these earlier urban warfare is the Battle of Badajoz in Spain in 1812, involving the British. This was during the Napoleonic War. Could you talk about that battle?
It was a classic example of siege warfare. Badajoz was a very, very old city, and the fortifications were these massive stone fortifications. And the Duke of Wellington had to figure out how to take the city. And so his engineers had figured out that there was a point in the wall at which they could just keep pounding it with cannonballs, with just these solid chunks of lead, and just keep hitting the, you know, that section of the wall until eventually it collapsed. So the French concentrate all their defenses on that one spot. The British send in a forlorn hope, which was usually the first group over the wall. It meant instant promotion if you were an officer and if you survived. But again, that usually wasn't very common for the first guys over the wall. But eventually, just a steady stream of troops, and you eventually got through. And once the wall had been taken, that's it. Pretty much the fight was over.
A development of modern urban warfare, we really start to see it in an unlikely place. It's an uprising in Paris, France. Could you talk about the Paris Commune uprising that occurred between March 18th and May 22nd in 1871?
The French had been very badly humiliated in 1870 when their armies had been decimated by the Prussians, by Otto von Bismarck and General von Moltke. And the Prussian armies had, they decimated the French army, but also they'd captured the Emperor Napoleon III and forced him to surrender. Government in Paris, more or less, tried to exercise some kind of governmental control. The Emperor had just surrendered. The Prussians ultimately surrounded Paris and pummeled the city until the French surrendered, ultimately, and then the Prussians withdrew. the people of Paris, who had been not only subject to this massive defeat, but also to a brutal siege, had been inspired very heavily by the writings of Karl Marx. This was actually the first left-wing uprising, and the people of Paris rose up and formed these communes. The idea was, you know, we're going to throw off the fat cats that are in charge of us, and we're going to take charge, and we are going to control our own destiny, you know, the real socialist ideal. And so what they did is they seized sections of the city and they built barricades, and they had militias, they had members of the National Guard, members of the French army who had brought guns. They didn't try to dig massive defensive networks outside the city. Their entire strategy centered around fighting house to house, street to street, funneling French soldiers into what would become choke points, narrow streets, forcing large French units into narrow streets and then ambushing them from the windows, from the barricades. And so this was really, for the first time in history, we see what one can consider almost a modern style of urban warfare. There wasn't necessarily a centralized leadership, there wasn't necessarily a centralized organization, because it followed sort of the socialist paradigm that we saw in the Spanish Civil War, with, you know, people electing their leaders and committees and committees and committees, which is great in theory, but the fact is it doesn't make for strong military leadership. And they weren't able to coordinate their efforts, they weren't able to bring supplies up to the fight as quickly, and of course the French army ultimately brought cannons onto the street and physically blasted the barricades with cannons.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. I'm Ken McDermott Rowe, your host, and I'm joined by Marshawn McDermott Rowe, our military affairs commentator. And in this segment of the show, we're talking about the development of modern urban warfare. Marshawn, as we move into the 20th century, two of the greatest examples of urban warfare were Stalingrad in 1942-1943, and at the end of the war, in the Battle for Berlin. Could you talk about the Battle of Stalingrad, which is now called Volgograd?
Stalingrad was the obsession of Adolf Hitler because it bore Stalin's name. It was the city of Stalin. So for Hitler, the symbolism was tremendous. But for the Russians, the symbolism became tremendous, because not necessarily a lot of Russians had a whole lot of love for Stalin, but Stalin came to represent Russian resistance, and so too did Stalingrad. Stalingrad was actually very poorly defended initially, because Stalin would waste his efforts in these hopeless defenses, refusing to allow his troops to retreat in battles like Kiev, where hundreds of thousands of Russian soldiers were surrounded, ultimately killed or captured by the Germans. So Stalingrad was caught off guard, and it was shelled and bombed by the Luftwaffe, by the German army. And as the German army moved in, there was really a handful of Russian troops and workers' militias defending the city. The Russians held onto a very narrow strip. You have to remember that the city of Stalingrad rests directly on the Volga River, and there was a very narrow strip of the city that was still held onto by the Russian army. General Zhukov used that as a kind of a beachhead to keep trying to funnel troops and supplies into the city, but it was very clear that he wasn't going to be able to hold the city for very long. What Zhukov ultimately did was he waited for Hitler to move the German forces, the German troops, because you got to remember, Hitler's army was an international army. It wasn't just Germans. He had Romanians, he had Italians, he had Spaniards. And so he moved his very well-trained German troops off of the flanks, sent them into the city. He left the Romanians protecting the flanks. So the Romanians were not as well-trained or organized or disciplined as the Germans or equipped. Zhukov ordered a brilliant crossing of the Volga and a flanking maneuver where he swept the German flank and surrounded the German troops in the city. When the German troops are surrounded by Zhukov, we see a very crucial facet of urban warfare, which was supplies. Because now, even though the Russians only controlled a beachhead inside the city, they had a direct line of supply to their troops on the edge of the city. Whereas the Germans, on the other hand, now their supply line had been cut. They were surrounded inside the city. They tried resupplying by air, but that was ultimately hopeless. And the air supplies either fell into Russian hands or never made it, because the Red Air Force started to gain air superiority. We also see what I like to term the four dimensions of urban warfare. The four dimensions of urban warfare are the air. Controlling the air is one dimension. Another dimension is the battle on the ground. Another dimension is the battle behind the lines, which is what we saw where the Germans were cut off from their line of supply. And then, of course, the fourth dimension, which is the subterranean war. The Germans termed it Rattenkrieg, which means the war of the rats. And it was really the War of the Rats, because they were fighting on every level of the city. They were fighting inside the buildings, they were fighting on street level, and they were fighting below ground. They were fighting in the sewers, they were fighting in the waterways. There were cases where you would have German troops controlling one floor of a building, Russian troops controlling another floor, and then Russians controlling the sewer, and then Germans controlling another section of the sewer. So the battle was happening really in every dimension imaginable. And this is really the first time in history when you see this kind of warfare occurring on so many different levels. We also see the advent of the use of commandos very heavily in urban warfare, and the use of snipers. Snipers, we discovered, well, the Russians discovered, could actually hold up not just platoons and companies, but even hold up whole battalions. Fighting through the rubble meant very slow progress. It meant intensely high casualties for both Russians and Germans just to gain control of one building. And it also meant very personal fighting, very close, very hands-on, because you're fighting each other in spaces that are the size of the average apartment building, because that's exactly what they were fighting in.
And in this kind of fighting, we're talking about the defenders fighting in very small groups, right? Snipers by themselves or groups of 5 or 10 Russian soldiers.
Exactly. It makes it distinct from battles such as Kursk, the sort of stereotypical what we consider Eastern European battles that we've talked about numerous times before, where large tank divisions sweeping across Eastern Europe. That is the war of Eastern Europe. That's the war of open terrain. That is a war that is still relevant and still very possible today. But urban warfare changes that dynamic, because in an urban setting, you can't move large tank divisions because of narrow roads, because of buildings being, in the case of Stalingrad, blown up, fighting for rubble, fighting for houses, apartments, offices. You move now to a much smaller level, not just to the battalion, brigade and battalion level, but now you're down at the company, the squad, the team. You have a three-man team can mean the difference between victory or defeat in a segment of the city. We do see a complete difference in doctrine when you're fighting inside a city or fighting for control of a city, than as opposed to if you're fighting in somewhere open, like if we were to fight across the steppes of Ukraine, or we were to fight across the steppes of Poland.
And the irony in the case of Stalingrad is that the besieger became the besieged. The Germans ended up not lasting out the winter of 1943 and had to surrender it to the Russians in February, and almost the entire German army was lost. It was a reversal that the German army never recovered from, which brings us to the last act of World War II in Europe, which is the Battle for Berlin, another excellent example of an urban warfare where the Russians now are on the offensive against Berlin. This took place in April and May of 1945. Can you talk about the Battle of Berlin?
Unlike Stalingrad, where the Russians were caught unprepared, the Germans instituted Operation Clausewitz, which was to make Berlin a frontline city. Any reasonable German knew that making Berlin a frontline city meant the end of the war. But what they were trying to do was keep the Russians at bay for as long as humanly possible till the Americans could show up, because the Russians were, and I mean this very literally, I'm not being colorful here, but I mean literally, they were rape and pillaging their way across Germany. So with Operation Clausewitz, Berlin became a front city, but this happened in advance enough that the Germans created what is termed layered defense. It was one defensive line, followed by another defensive line, followed by another defensive line, starting really with the Zalo Heights outside of Berlin. Very hilly, rocky, wooded area outside the city, which was a natural defensive barrier. But then further into the city, they had another layer of trenches and defensive networks. And then inside the city, you had, again, repeating layers of defenses, ultimately culminating with the Reichschancellery and the Führerbunker at the center.
And of course, the Germans were hopelessly outnumbered at this stage of the war. The Russians had amassed an army of 2.5 million soldiers with huge numbers of tanks, artillery, and aircraft to bring to bear on the final act, the capture of Berlin. And the regular German army at this point in Berlin was down to 45,000 troops, supplemented by the police force, the Hitler Youth, and 60,000 recruits called the Volkssturm.
Exactly. The Volkssturm, the People's Storm, as it was termed. Basically, more or less ordinary civilians that were too old to be drafted, or too not quite old enough to graduate the Hitler Youth yet. What you really glean from the Battle of Berlin is how such a small force, again, really, like you said, only about 40,000 professional soldiers. You have your police officers, you have your Hitler Youth, but really only about 40,000 professional soldiers, and largely limited trained police officers and ill-trained Hitler Youth and Volkssturm held up a Russian army of close to 1.5 million men. In fact, actually, it's important to note that Stalin, he sent three army groups commanded by General Chuikov, General Konev, and General Zhukov. And so these were also, coincidentally, Stalin's three best commanders. But you imagine he's sending three army groups against one city, 1.5 million men against less than 100,000 defenders, only 40,000 of which are professionals. And the amount of casualties that were inflicted upon the Russians, I mean, you look at it, they suffered 300,000 casualties, lost about 2,000 tanks, 2,000 artillery pieces, and 900 aircraft. That's a staggering, staggering ratio when you look at, relatively speaking, what the defenders had to bear.
So the Russians are willing, perhaps this is a cultural point too, the Russians are willing to put up with horrendous casualties to get what they want.
Oh, absolutely. That is the moral of Russian history, where, particularly in the United States, we lose 50 soldiers. It's considered a very, very costly day. For the Russians, that is a drop in the bucket. They historically, whether we're talking Chechnya or whether we're talking Stalingrad or Berlin, will suffer innumerable casualties, hundreds of thousands, in order to gain victory. And it's worth noting that during World War II, Russia suffered 20 million casualties. And I just would like our listeners to grasp that number. That includes military and civilians. But I just imagine that 20 million Russians died during World War II. And that is a staggering, staggering number of human beings.
And at this point of the war, the Germans really had no hope for getting more ammunition or reinforcements. They had the Americans closing in on them from the west and the Russians coming from the east. They had some hopes, or Hitler had some hopes, that the Americans would come to the sea, that his real enemy was the Russians. But and ultimately we did start to oppose the Russians, but it wasn't going to come in time to help the Germans.
No, not at all. And in fact, it was really a forlorn hope that they'd be able to hold off the Russians till they could negotiate. But it was quite impressive, because Hitler was ordering around armies that didn't exist. They only existed on paper. He ordered like Wenck's army to come and break the encirclement. And of course, Wenck's army could not move because he not only didn't have any fuel, but he also had too many wounded, didn't have enough ammunition. Actually, he was not combat effective. And so really, with the very, very limited resources that the Germans had, they held out surprisingly well and inflicted, again, a staggering number of casualties. And this demonstrates better than any other battle the inherent risk that comes along with urban warfare. The fact that even though you may have, and I'd like to correct my number from earlier, it was actually 2.5 million Russians, not 1.5, but 2.5 million Russians engaged in the battle in spite of overwhelming superior numbers, the Russians still suffered significant casualties.
The Germans, despite their resistance, of course, were defeated. Hitler committed suicide on April the 30th, and the survivors surrendered 2 days later. If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. I'm Ken McDermott-Rowe, your host, and I'm joined by Marshawn McDermott-Rowe, our military affairs commentator, and we've been talking about the development of modern urban warfare. So Marshawn, I'd like to move on to a current war, that is the United States war in Iraq. And an excellent example of modern urban warfare is the Battle of Najaf, which took place between August 5th and August 27th in 2004. This, of course, took place about 1 year after the United States had invaded Iraq. It had overthrown the government of Saddam Hussein and was ruling Iraq through a provisional government that it appointed and controlled. So can you talk about how a battle came to take place at this juncture in Najaf?
Najaf is the spiritual center for not just Iraqi Shiites, but for the Shia world. And it became the center of Shiite resistance to the U.S. occupation. And in 2004, there was a general uprising in the city, and Muqtada al-Sadr's militia, the Mahdi Army, seized control of most of the city. Now, United States Marines were sent in to squash what presumably should have been a relatively simple uprising, but actually turned out to be far, far more complex. And they ultimately had to bring in the army to support the Marines in order to attempt to retake the city. And even then, the city actually held out against overwhelming U.S. firepower and U.S. technology.
Could you talk about the leader of the Shia resistance in Iraq, in Najaf, Qatada al-Sadr, and his use of symbolism?
Absolutely. Well, it's very important to note that Muqtada al-Sadr was a very young man. He was actually, relatively speaking, he was only 31 at the time of the battle. But he was a very important figure because he is a descendant of the Prophet Muhammad, which in the Shiite world is very, very symbolic. And it's very important because they believe in the hereditary leadership from the Prophet Muhammad. But also, he was the son of martyrs. His father had been murdered by Saddam Hussein. His uncle, Musa al-Sadr, had been murdered by Muammar Gaddafi. And they were all, of course, very important Shiite clerics. So the symbolism was tremendous with this man. And he was very charismatic.
Didn't he, in fact, make his headquarters at the very important Imam Ali Shrine in Najaf, which, of course, is associated with the person who's regarded as the ancestor of the Shia, Muhammad's grandson, Ali.
Exactly. And it's very important to note that, again, talking about this lineage of martyrs, by being a descendant of the Prophet Muhammad, he's a descendant of Ali, who was himself martyred. He is descendant. His father was martyred. His uncle was martyred. And so by headquartering himself there, he not only made the statement that I am prepared to fight and die against the Americans, but to stand with me is also to stand with your prophet. It is to stand with the martyrs of your faith, the Shiite philosophy, the Shiite school of thought in Islam. So the symbolism not only reached out to the Iraqi Shiites, but it reached out far beyond. It was the reason why the Iranians funneled so much support, arms and training, and even some speculate personnel to support Muqtada al-Sadr. Again, the symbolism.
Well, he dressed in white, correct?
Exactly. I was going to mention that. The symbolism to Muqtada al-Sadr, he was a master of the art of propaganda. You know, for better or for worse, he was, because he also dressed himself in all white, which is the symbol of martyrdom in the Muslim world, and particularly in the Shiite world. So, because it is the robes that a martyr is supposed to be buried in. So he stood in front of Imam Ali Mosque and basically said, I am here to die. I'm not here to fight, to negotiate. I'm not here to win. I'm here to die. And martyrdom, especially the Shiites, is prized very heavily. So standing on the grave of a martyr, of Imam Ali, ready for martyrdom, just the symbolism cannot be lost. And so this mobilized the people of Najaf and the wider Shiite world.
And he did fight tactically a battle of Rattenkrieg, right?
Absolutely. The battle of Najaf, one of the most interesting facets, was a battle for one of the world's oldest graveyards. It's also one of the world's largest graveyards. It's multi-leveled. So the Marines actually had to fight the Mahdi army, who were running through tunnels in the graveyards. They would pop up, they would ambush, and they would disappear again. So it was really Rattenkrieg, fighting from windows, ambushes in the streets. And again, we talk about the four dimensions of warfare. You know, the first dimension, of course, the air. We had air superiority, but this is one of the most holy sites in Shiite Islam. We can't exactly flatten the city, because if we do, politically speaking, makes our situation far, far worse, because we think we have an uprising to deal with now. We're going to have a much wider uprising. So we did have air superiority, which helped, but it wasn't a tide changer. But then, of course, there was the facet of the battle occurring on the streets, the battles for the buildings, the battle for control of the blocks, of every city block. And then, of course, the Rattenkrieg, the battle for control of the graveyards, the battle going on below level. But then we also see, especially emphasized here, the battle behind the lines. Because while this battle's going on, unlike sieges historically, like the Siege of Badajoz, where the British had full control around the city, we were fighting an insurgency. Still, during this uprising, we were fighting an insurgency behind our lines. Our supply convoys were being ambushed. Reinforcements were being ambushed. There were Shiite militias attacking the rear, as well as attacking U.S. forces in other parts of the country. Not to mention, we were still tangling with the Sunni insurgency as well. So this was multi-tiered in terms of the battle going on inside the city itself, but the battle going on outside the city, which was affecting the fight inside the city.
Now, we ended up, because of the very good tactics used by the defenders, having to agree to a ceasefire, allowing the Shia militia to keep its weapons, and Sadr's supporters became part of the Iraqi government, winning seats in the parliamentary election in Iraq that was held in January. So, of course, this was not the outcome that we had sought. Marshawn, as we come to the end of the show, could you go over some of the lessons that can be learned from the study of the development of urban warfare?
Absolutely. The first would be, of course, choosing your ground well, knowing where you have a strong base of support. Best example of that is, again, the Battle of Najaf. Choosing somewhere that is a hub for your supporters, that is a strong natural base of support, is essential, because we see that with the Easter Rising. They didn't choose a city that was their base of support. The city actually was predominantly loyalist, and the rebels lost. Another important lesson would be to exploit physical features of the city to protect your forces. Again, utilizing the graveyards in Najaf, but also in Stalingrad, utilizing the sewage system to protect your forces from being bombed by the Luftwaffe, you go underground. And so, you know, utilizing those physical features is essential. Understand propaganda and use the symbols to unite and inspire. Stalingrad was a city that bore Stalin's name. Najaf was the symbolic and spiritual home of the Iraqi Shia, and indeed the world Shias. Know propaganda. Know the symbolism behind what you're fighting for, because if you try to get your army to fight for something that really not only your people see as irrelevant, but your soldiers don't see as particularly relevant, people are less willing to die for something that is just a piece of land, as opposed to something that is part of at least their spirit or part of their national being. The other point would be hit the enemy where they are most vulnerable while moving with limited maneuverability on city streets. That part's always easier said than done. But often, in terms of hitting the enemy where they are most vulnerable, they're most vulnerable behind the lines. So the encirclement in Stalingrad, forcing the Germans into the city and cutting off their line of supply. But also in terms of, as the Iraqis did during the Battle of Najaf, striking out at our forces advancing into the city, hitting our supply lines, things like that, hitting where we were vulnerable. Another important lesson is force the enemy into attacking targets, which will further antagonize the locals. Again, Najaf is the prime example. The United States could not bomb the Imam Ali Mosque, which was the headquarters of Muqtada al-Sadr, because if we did, it would ultimately not just antagonize the Iraqi Shiites, but it would antagonize Shiites around the world. And certainly the short-term gain of killing al-Sadr would ultimately be completely overshadowed by the long-term effect of having a ever-widening resistance. And let's not forget, the Shiites were the ones that we were trying to bring into the government. So for Sadr to do this, it was, again, trying to force us to attack some that would antagonize the locals. And finally, the most important lesson for any defender: get allies outside the city to harass the enemy's rear and maintain your own line of supply. Because if you can make life very difficult for the guys outside the city, if you can keep ammunition, food, and medical supplies coming to you, but you can stop them or hinder them from going to the enemy that's besieging you, then again, you have gained the advantage. And that was an example in Stalingrad. That's what Hitler tried to do in the Battle of Berlin, but ultimately was unsuccessful. And certainly something the Iraqis did, much to the chagrin of U.S. forces, during the Battle of Najaf. And these, I think, would be the most important lessons for any defender in the event of an invasion.
Thank you very much, Marchand. That's it for this edition of the In Context War Report. The In Context War Report is produced by MDR Productions, Inc. and is broadcast at noon on the fourth Monday of the month on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. You can stream or download this or prior editions of the War Report to your computer or mobile device from our website, incontextreport.com, or from SoundCloud under WPKN Community Radio. The show is also archived at Radio for All. You can watch our videos on the In Context Report YouTube channel, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and write to us at ken@mdrtalk.org. That's ken@mdrtalk.org. On behalf of In Context military affairs commentator Marshawn McDermott Rowe, this is your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. Thanks for listening. See you next time.